Welcome to the Engaged Midwife Podcast. This is Missy.
And this is Kara.
Oh my gosh, what a whirlwind this has been.
It is.
I picked a topic today that I am seeing a lot of, and I think it's certainly a case of where I work.
Well, yes, except for the fact that what we're going to be talking about, everyone is seeing more of, and that's obesity in pregnancy and induction of labor.
Yes. And so there's going to be a lot of things I think that we talk about in this realm of things, but specifically we're talking today about obesity, induction of labor, and what happens with the obese patient in the intrapartum period.
Yeah. So about 50% of people that give birth are either overweight or obese, and it's broken down by about half of each. So 25%, 25.6% of birthing people are overweight, which is a BMI that is 25 to 29.9. And then the other 25%, 24.4%, is people that are obese, and that is a BMI of 30 or greater.
And I work in a place where we routinely see people with BMI of 40 or greater.
Well, I do too. I mean, we're both in the Midwest. We sometimes pack on the pounds and eat really well.
I mean, yeah.
Or we don't have good access to nutrition, and people live in food deserts and that sort of thing. And so,
I mean, it's so certainly nutrition is a social determinant, right?
It is, yes.
And so that is something that we have to consider in the context of obesity. But there is some physiology that goes into this as well.
I know, it's fascinating.
And it sometimes, I think, has to do with increasing amounts of adipose tissue and decreased, like, actual normal physiologic progression to labor.
Yes.
Right. So we know that women who are obese generally don't go into spontaneous labor before 41 weeks, like their non-obese counterparts.
Exactly.
And so what do we end up with then?
We end up with inductions and cervical ripening and different things to hopefully get them into labor.
And rarely do I see a patient who is obese without other comorbidities.
Right. I mean, it's so common to have some hypertensive disorders or diabetes, if not other things like just pain syndromes and different things like that. Asthma.
So a lot of times what I am seeing right now is induction of labor with pregnancy complicated by obesity.
Right.
But also pre-gestational diabetes, or because now they are either a chronic hypertensive that needs to be induced, or a gestational hypertensive that needs to be induced, or a superimposed now preeclamptic that needs to be induced. And so we are inducing people earlier.
Right.
When we know good and well that just because of their obesity, they probably weren't going to go into spontaneous labor before 41 weeks.
I think that's one of the most important things, is that it isn't that we're having to induce someone that's not ready. They may never be ready.
Yes. Physiologically, obesity may prevent them from spontaneous labor.
Exactly. Exactly. And the biggest takeaway I think you guys are going to get from us is that labor induction and the dose of those agents that we have to use is totally related to the patient's BMI.
Agreed. There's a really great systematic review. The lead author is Jessica Ellis. It was in the Journal of Midwifery and Women's Health. It was published in 2019. I'm really proud of Jessica for her work on this. So if you're listening, Jessica, like, kudos to you.
Shout out, Jess.
This is such an important topic. Kira really hit the nail on the head when she said, like, it really has to do with dose of what we use.
Yes.
But I also want to say that labor induction is associated with, we know this, longer labor course, dysfunctional labor patterns, increased use of interventions, and longer hospital stays. And it is way more common for all of those things to be exaggerated with increased BMI.
Yeah.
And the number one unintended outcome, or I guess, undesired outcome, is we really drive up the cesarean rate with women who are obese because of failed induction.
And these are not great surgical candidates. And by that, we mean that the surgery itself is more complicated. The wound healing is complicated. The injuries that can occur to the delivery staff are increased. So all of these different things can occur with increased induction rates, increased cesarean rates.
So this particular article that we are referencing right now is a systematic review. It was 10 studies.
And meta-analysis.
Yes.
I mean, that's
really high-level stuff.
Kudos to this team.
Yeah. 10 studies that they looked at, an N of almost 8,000, which is a huge number of what we were talking about, pregnant women enrolled in studies. And I want to talk, I want to preface some of the things we're going to talk about later with the discussion of this article. And we just said this, women with obesity, according to this study, are nearly two times more likely than women of normal weight to end up with a C-section. And we just said, Kara just very clearly said, these are not great surgical candidates.
Right. Right.
Also, that length of labor tends to increase with increasing BMI, right? It's very much correlated. And you also have to use higher doses, right? Like number of doses of ripening agents and higher amounts than of like synthetic oxytocin.
And I think that's really important to know. These are not the patients that get like a dose of Cytotec and then go straight to PIT. It would not be unusual that they need repeated doses of a cervical ripening agent and higher doses than what we would typically use.
Side note, we're going to get back to that at the end because I want to talk for a good minute at the end of this about shared decision-making and what I talk to patients about in the setting of induction of labor and dose it like in two-stage induction.
Yeah. So let's talk about, we said that we may need more prostaglandins. We may need more oxytocin, and that is compared to normal weight women in these studies.
Right. I will say that this, before we get to, like meso and oxytocin, I do want to say that in the meta-analysis, they did point out that when we're talking about ripening methods, that like cervical ripening balloons, so Cook catheters and Foley bulbs, are actually maybe more effective in women with obesity than prostaglandins. And so you have to weigh, obviously, management decisions, and you can't put a Foley bulb in somebody who's not at least 1 centimeter dilated. But because we know that they're going to take more and more doses of medication, the Foley bulb can be a good option.
Yeah, agreed. For ripening. There just wasn't a lot of mention of the balloons. And so I think now, knowing what practice has been like for the last few years, the studies would look different.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
They did, though, talk about cervical ripening agents and found that meso was probably the most effective cervical ripening agent that was used. And we've kind of mentioned that already. We'll talk more about it in the future because there's a good study just about meso as well.
I think that's where we'll go.
Okay. Well, I want to mention that I think one of the major clinical implications that this systematic review and meta-analysis came up with is that we should base our decisions about management on the BMI at time of delivery. I've always really gotten frustrated that people always reported the BMI when they came in labor because I'm like, well, really, like, it's about their pre-pregnancy BMI. And that is true when we're talking about antepartum management and projected weight gain and how we counsel patients in the antepartum. But when we're actually talking about intrapartum management and delivery, it has everything to do with their BMI when they come in for labor.
The article actually says hospital admission BMI.
Right. Because that tells us a lot about how much weight they may have gained during pregnancy and what their adiposity is right at that time.
Right, right. All right. Anything else?
I think that's it.
So I want to talk about meso for a second. And I have some thoughts before we get into a discussion of this particular article.
Okay.
And it's only because I have done some looking into this literature, and one of my favorite docs, shout out to Lindsay Zamora if she's listening, talks a lot about, like, are we using meso in a way that's actually studied?
Yeah.
And we are not.
Well, it's off label, right?
A lot of the studies on induction of labor using meso are oral administration. So giving it to them like a pill, they literally orally ingest it. And the so the off-label uses, right, are vaginal and buccal side attack.
Yeah.
And if you look at the actual, like, studied literature on induction of labor and meso, it is oral administration.
So fascinating, because I've actually never used it orally.
Correct. And, you know, we got into this long conversation on labor and delivery the other night, and she came from a place that, like, only uses oral. Oh. And she was like, it's because that's what's been studied.
Fascinating.
And I was like, oh, duh. And I feel like I work in a place that does a lot of very evidence-based things.
Agreed.
And that's not what we're doing.
Right.
She will also tell you, Dr. Zamora will also tell you, like, pick a route and stick with it.
Mm-hmm.
I hate vaginal meso.
And that's predominantly what I've done.
The reason I hate it is after two doses, the vagina is a desert.
Yes.
It will cause, like, a very significant drying out of the vaginal tissues. And then when you go to check somebody, it doesn't matter how much gel you have on your glove, getting into their vagina is not comfortable. Also think most people don't have an epidural during ripening, right? It is very difficult to get to their cervix, and it makes their makes their vagina tender.
But, you know, like, I have found it not to be as bad as, like, Cervidil, which we used a ton when I was early in my career.
Yeah.
And I didn't choose it for myself because of how uncomfortable it makes patients.
I hate Cervidil because I used to tell people, it was like rolling up $500 and throwing it in somebody's vagina just so it, like, falls out in the toilet like an hour later.
Super expensive.
Super expensive and not that effective. Doesn't stay where it needs to stay.
And we taped it to their leg because, holy cow, we didn't want to have to waste
it. Fall out in the toilet.
Yeah.
Yes. But so that's the reason I don't love vaginal. And I used to tell the residents, like, if you want to put in a vaginal, that's great, but I'm going to make you switch.
Okay.
Also, we only do 25 of vaginal.
Uh-huh.
And I do 50 of buccal. And so I tell my residents that you can do 25 every 4 hours in their vagina. Mm-hmm. And that means you don't get to a dose of 100 of Cytotec for 16 hours.
Okay.
You can use buccal Cytotec every 6 hours, 50. So you get to a dose of 100 in 12 hours.
Oh, okay.
So we can increase the amount of Cytotec they're getting in a decreased amount of time if we use a different route.
Okay.
Also, I can fix a dry mouth. I cannot fix a dry vagina.
Okay. Is there, now I feel like there was some risk of buccal or oral with increased temperature.
I think it's a risk with
any
Cytotec in general. Okay. And I could be wrong. That would be something that I would definitely need to look up about fever, but definitely fever is on the list of side effects with Cytotec. So I guess the bigger conversation about Cytotec in general is, are we using it the way we should be using it? Is it there a more effective way to do it?
Right.
I would like to get oral put on our, like, protocol of like what we use it for, because I think if there's studies about it, then we should be using it that way.
Sure.
And because I dislike the side effects of vaginal Cytotec so much that I tend to not use it that way.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it just depends on where you work. It depends on what your protocols look like, what they're comfortable with using. I've heard some people that do 50 of vaginal, and I'm like, we've never done 50 of vaginal. We've only ever done 50 of buccal, right? I've never put 50 in somebody's vagina.
Right.
Unless it's like, you know, a meso miffy situation for, you know what I mean? A demise or you know, something like that. And that's usually oral.
Right.
Think about that. Think about how we use miffy and meso for IUFDs or, you know, medical necessity abortions, right?
Mm-hmm.
We use all that oral.
Right.
We use all that Miffy and Meso oral. So, you know, it works.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
So, okay. So I digress. I think there are things that we're doing that maybe aren't evidence-based and maybe we should look at them. And I feel a little strongly about it because I see so much Meso being used. I mean, the pharmacy at Vandy probably thinks that we like literally are running like a candy factory with Meso on special because yeah. we use so much of it. But it's because we're dealing with all these patients who have increased BMI.
Yes.
So back to this topic and Meso.
Yes.
What do we know?
Okay. So there's a really interesting article that came out of Denmark in 2021. And it's actually from the journal Obesity Research and Clinical Practice. So it's not from the obstetric journals, but from obesity medicine. And it was really interesting because in these studies, the first study had about 700 women, the second study had over 1,000, and they studied the use of Meso to start labor. And it was, you know, well done. I think it's really interesting. But one of the main things was the Meso dose, and then the women that went on to deliver by BMI category. And so we probably should outline those. We said what obesity was, is the BMI over 30, but we can break it down into classes.
Yes. So obesity, so class one obesity is BMI of 30 to 34.9. Class two is 35 to 39.9. And class three is anything over 40.
Right.
So it's important to recognize that. And I think what's interesting about the article you're talking about is the best piece of data from this entire article is one line of one table.
Well, and they didn't just look at obese women.
Yes, they actually had, in this study, they had 900 people who were of normal BMI.
Right.
They had another 50 that were underweight.
And then about 400 or so were overweight.
I think that what's interesting too about this particular study is that the correlation continues from underweight through normal, through overweight, and then through all of the obesity classes.
So when we said that the Meso dose is BMI dependent, it is 100% true with this line of data.
Yes. One line.
Yes. So share it with us.
Okay. So the range of Meso doses from women who are underweight to women who have class three obesity is 122 to 271. That is a swing of 150, right?
Mm-hmm. Micrograms.
Micrograms of Meso.
Well, and the total, and those were the averages.
Those were the averages.
Total doses were anywhere from 95 up to 325.
So go back to what I said a minute ago about how you can get to those doses.
Yeah.
If the lowest dose was 95 and you're giving 25 vaginally every 4 hours, to get to 95, it's 16 hours.
Yeah.
The highest dose is 325. Imagine how long your patient will lay there in a ripening phase.
Oh, I've seen it.
For 3 days.
Yeah.
So these are the things to consider. Now I'm going to break down this line for you.
Yes.
So underweight and normal, and then I'll do overweight. The range for women who are underweight to normal weight was 95 to 185.
Mm-hmm.
185. I mean, again, to get to 185, you're still 30 some odd hours if you're using 25 vaginally.
Yes.
Right? Now, there are protocols where you can use 100 orally.
Mm-hmm.
If you use 100 orally every, you know, 6 hours, mm-hmm. you're getting to 200 in 12 hours.
Yeah.
So I think that's a reason to consider doing higher doses of oral.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But these total doses, okay. So I said 95 to 185, and those are women who are underweight or normal weight.
Mm-hmm.
In overweight women, the mean was 193.
Mm-hmm.
So not that much higher, but the total dose range was 180 to 205. 205.
Yeah, I mean, around 200 micrograms
right.
for overweight women.
Class one obesity, 233 average, right? With a high end of 257.
Yes.
Class two obesity, so these are the women 39.9 as a reminder, an average of 251
mm-hmm.
with a high end of 282 and a low of 221.
Mm-hmm.
And then women who are obese in a category of over BMI over 40, an average of 271 with a range of 216 to 325.
Wow.
So when I talk to students, any kind of learner, and they say, well, she's had 6 doses of Cytotec. I say, I don't care how many doses she's had. What is her total dose amount?
Yeah.
And they'll say 125 or 150. And I'll be like, what's the max dose of Cytotec that we should be giving people? And most of them don't know. And I say, the research says 300.
Yeah.
And they're like, 300's a lot. I'm like, well, 300's a lot if you're only giving 25 at a time.
Right. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think you have to consider not just, oh, I've given 4 doses of vaginal Cytotec.
Mm-hmm.
You have to consider how much Cytotec you've given. Because if you or I were just talking and I said you gave 4 doses of Cytotec, people would be like, wah, wah, wah.
Yeah.
I mean, but that could only be 100.
Yeah.
And honestly, the only people that 100 of, there's not a single person on this table that 100 of Cytotec is actually working.
Good point. Yeah.
When I show, this is a particular thing I share with learners, is I want you to consider what their BMI is. I want you to look at this chart and I want you to tell me how much Cytotec you should really be giving somebody to achieve ripening in induction of labor.
Well, and we mentioned how this increases by weight class, but it is statistically significant increases by weight class, which is really important to note.
Yeah. The conclusion of this meso study from this very specific journal on obesity is that meso dose and time from induction delivery and risk of cesarean, all 3 of those things increase significantly with increasing passive BMI. So increased dose, time from induction delivery, increased risk of C-section.
Yeah.
But for me, the biggest takeaway clinically is, how much meso do I need to use in these women to get them delivered?
So I think this is a really good point about the amount of dose, the number of doses. But if we tie this together with the systematic review and meta-analysis, one of their conclusions was also that patience is a virtue. Things will take longer. So I think these are kind of coming together with the same idea.
Yes. So there are some other articles and really good information, I think, about obesity and induction, or just obesity in the intrapartum period. And we have talked about some of the things, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there's a lot of comorbidities, and some of those comorbidities come with risk of stillbirth, right?
Right.
And what should we be doing, right? In terms of managing comorbidities, managing pregnancy complication, managing risk for stillbirth, right?
Right.
And we can't do a lot of expectant management in women who have class 1, 2, and 3 obesity.
Right. So from an article that came out in 2022 from the Best Practices for Research in Clinical Obstetrics and Gynecology, the lead author on this was Ashraf. I think one of the most important things that they talk about is that offering induction of labor between 39 and 40 weeks is probably closely associated with clinical and cost benefits.
Yes.
So again, we've said most of these people are going to need induction. You don't need to wait to induce them at 41 weeks because they are most likely going to need to be induced. And we can maybe reduce some of the clinical complications and so forth if we just do it sooner.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in their study, they're like, hey, there's not a lot of great studies that have a lot of great data. But, you know, you have to understand that in so many cases, we have suboptimally dosed people with induction agents, which I think is really also super interesting.
This team also says that we should allow sufficient time for labor to progress with higher doses of oxytocin. So we talked about cervical ripening, but these people will also need more oxytocin.
They will need, yes. And I funny enough, I heard somebody, I was, you know, you and I like are always perusing social media for what we see and what we hear and what midwives and nurses are talking about. And I saw something the other day that they said that their patient had a BMI of like 50 and they were on like 60 of Pitocin. Mm-hmm. There is, and I don't know what the research backing is, and this would be something for me to look up, but like, do we have good research on oxytocin and how much we can increase the dose safely?
Yeah, I don't think we do. And we've all, there's been so much about risk of uterine rupture that people get scared.
Yes. And I also have like, I don't know, I have some interesting like clinical things and some articles that I've been looking at about increasing doses of oxytocin. And what happens if we turn oxytocin off when patients get to active labor? Yeah. Because in the newer research, it will tell you that the body will actually kick in. Once you use oxytocin to get somebody to 6 centimeters, their body will take over and then they don't really need the Pitocin anymore, which is probably why pit breaks in active labor actually work.
Right.
Not because it's resetting the receptors, but more because we know that if we just turn it off, that the body is like, oh yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do.
And then we're not causing tachysystole.
It's like we're going to nudge somebody enough with oxytocin to be like, body, you should be in labor.
Yeah.
Body, you should be in labor. And then when it gets to active labor, we're like, turn off the pit. And the body's like, oh yeah, you told me I was supposed to be in labor.
I got this.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I could go on and on about what I feel like we are not doing right in terms of advocating for patients and making sure we have vaginal deliveries.
I think one of the important things that you said is that we could go higher with our oxytocin and that we shouldn't be shocked if we need those higher doses. And, you know, I mean, how many times have I had someone that's on like 20 or 30 of pit and there's like no contractions picking up and everybody assumes it's because she's fluffy and we're just not picking them up. But this article also suggests that in this population, it might be really good to use an intrauterine pressure catheter so that you do know exactly how strong your contractions are. You do know exactly how frequent they are, and that will allow you to feel safer going on those higher doses.
We've talked about interventions. So IUPC requires rupture of membranes. So it's like a whole set of interventions, right? This article also talks about early epidural.
It does.
Mm-hmm. And how that can be advantageous. I already just talked about how a vagina gets uncomfortable with a lot of doses of vaginal cytotec. Mm-hmm. You've got an epidural, it doesn't matter.
What's funny to me is that one of their major takeaways is that you should have strict adherence to protocols for the management of labor, which to me feels like strict adherence to protocols for labor management sounds like time, but it's not so much that as follow your good dosage administrations, follow your good safety things, but then that idea of sufficient time should be allowed.
Another midwife that I work with and I feel super passionate about how we're doing a disservice to obese women. So you and I have talked about this. I have been collecting a ton of articles about obesity and what we should be doing differently in hopes that we can do like put together an evidence-based protocol for women in certain classes of obesity and how much meso we should be using, how much oxytocin we should be using. I mean, I think the rest of it's clinical management, like judgment, right? Do you need an epidural? Do you need an IUPC? What do you need to ensure that you're monitoring your patients effectively? But really, the protocol would be more based on dosing so that people just wouldn't be afraid to like do the things that need to be done.
Yeah, I think so often when we talk about the care of obese women, we've always focused on, do we have the right supplies? Do we have the right type of bed and OR table? Do we have the things to keep our staff safe? And it's nice to now think about people are really looking at, okay, yeah, but we need to look at what are the right doses and what are the right timeframes and those sorts of things, and understanding that physiologically things work different for these patients.
Yeah. When you think about the wrap up, right, of this, and I just want to briefly talk for a second about an article that was published in AJOG, a research article, in 2011. It's an older article, but I just think it's important to realize that 12 years ago, that this article, The Effect of Maternal Obesity on Rate of Failed Induction of Labor, basically said like, hey, We know obesity is associated with increased risk of failed induction, and it's directly related and correlated with class of obesity.
Yeah.
And we've known this for all these years.
And it matches with that other data that says these women are more, 2 times more likely to end in C-section.
In people that we have continued to say are not good surgical candidates.
Exactly.
So this, for me, is the conversation that I wanted to have at the end of this, which was about shared decision-making, informed consent. Mm-hmm. And you can take this conversation any way you want to in terms of who you use it for.
Right.
But knowing what I know about meso,
mm-hmm.
and knowing what I know about two-stage inductions. So we've talked about ripening stage and induction mm-hmm. stage. I have a long conversation when people get to my hospital, when I am on call, about expectations.
Right.
I said, we have 4 induction slots every night shift when I work. It's 8 p.m., 10 p.m., midnight, and 5 a.m. And my 8 and 10 and 12 o'clock, when they come in, we talk about Bishop score.
Mm-hmm.
A Bishop score under 8 means 8 or under needs a ripening phase.
Right.
And so people will be like, well, her Bishop score is 7. And I'm like, it's not 8. For me, it's 8.
Mm-hmm.
And the research, it's 8. And so until somebody gets to 8, we shouldn't be switching over to oxytocin.
Right.
Could we use something in combination like meso and a Foley catheter? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But we should not be switching over to oxytocin until we have a Bishop score of 8.
Mm-hmm.
So the conversation for me, and especially in women who are obese, and especially in women who I know I'm going to have to use a ton of meso for, is we're going to get you settled, ask you a million annoying questions, scan to make sure your baby's vertex, get you to sign some consents. We consent every patient for C-section when they walk in the door.
Oh yeah, always. Yeah.
We, in smaller community hospitals, they do not do that.
Oh, I always have everywhere I've worked.
But we have also worked in some like high risk places.
Yeah.
And also we have residents who do all of those consents. So
mm-hmm.
We're going to have you do all these things. And we are going to give you your first dose for ripening, whether it's in your vagina or in your mouth. And then I would like you to take some melatonin, Benadryl, or Unisom.
Yeah, something.
I need you to sleep. And if they say, I don't have a problem sleeping, great. Because I'm going to do this first thing and then I'm going to need you to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
And if we do something vaginal, we got to wake you up in 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But if we do something buccal, we don't have to wake you up for 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I am teeing people up for day shift.
Well, I mean, and I'm sure you find that one of the questions that people always ask is, when do you think we'll have the baby? And I'm talking about like, we can't even begin to really predict that until you're ripened. And we really can't even tell you then because we need to get you into active labor. So you're right. It's about managing expectations and really letting people know, like, you're not having your baby before midnight.
Well, my speech is always ripening will take at least 24 hours.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't take 24 hours, great.
You're pleasantly surprised.
But ripening is going to take 24 hours and it's going to be 24 hours of you being here, us giving you medicine, either every 4 or 6 hours, maybe getting a Foley balloon, but being here.
Let your family go home. They do not need to be camping out in the waiting.
Correct. You're also only going to be on liquids.
Yeah.
So the other thing I have gotten more comfortable with is, after 24 hours of ripening, if somebody's going to need continued ripening, is a meal
uh-huh.
and a shower.
Yes.
After 24 hours and then continuing.
Yeah.
Because like starving somebody in labor, first off, there's no good literature that says anywhere that we should be restricting PO intake in labor.
Right.
When people are in labor, real labor, they don't want to eat.
Right.
Back to this story about Rory's delivery. Like I wanted not one thing to eat that whole day.
Yeah.
I wanted to drink. I felt very thirsty. Well,
and if you're remote from delivery, like it'll make you more comfortable. It may make your uterus actually more efficient if it's been fed.
Well, and what happens, the biggest rate limiting step in PO intake is anesthesia.
It is. And thankfully I have been in places where if we were remote from delivery and we had reassuring monitoring to start with, we could sometimes have some light snacks, which is nice. But I totally agree with a break for a shower and a meal at 24 hours.
It also improves morale.
Yes, for everyone.
Yes. And it is not, I think, when we talk about, well, they're like, well, we need to keep going with her induction. I'm like, let's be humans.
Yes.
And realize that this person's already been in the bed for 24 hours. She's likely hungry and tired, needs to clean.
Well, and restricted movement's not good for DVT risk. This is already someone that's got increased risk.
Right. So the conversation for me is, we're going to start this, get some sleep. We will reassess in the morning.
Yes.
Right. But I think a good conversation about Bishop score, a good conversation about how often we can give medication and what kind of medications mm-hmm. we can give and what the timeline looks like is also helpful for building expectations. So this goes back to the idea of my doctoral research, which why were women so dissatisfied when they were induced? Mm-hmm. They would come into the office and be so angry that they were like, I had a terrible experience. I laid in the bed for 3 days. I ended up with a C-section, whatever. Ultimately, they weren't mad that they had a C-section. And ultimately, they were actually really happy that they had their baby. Mm-hmm. What it came down to is nobody had that conversation with them when they got to the hospital or set the expectation the day that their induction was scheduled.
Right.
Because we were saying in another episode, like it's really hard to get in these conversations in the office mm-hmm. and have a really long conversation about induction and Bishop score and what this means and how long you're going to be in the hospital. And unless you're in a private practice where you have a lot of time with each patient, mm-hmm. you don't get that.
Right.
And so we have a lot of patients who come to the hospital who have no idea what to expect. Mm-hmm. They also don't understand that their induction is not a reservation.
Yeah, exactly.
This is not the Holiday Inn.
And there is different acuity of patients and there is elective versus medically indicated. Yeah.
Did we already do a medical indications for induction of labor?
I can't remember. We'll have to go back and look. And if not,
that might be another good one. So I think when patients, especially patients who are obese, come in, I think expectation setting is amazing. Mm-hmm. I also think that the team needs to be on board mm-hmm. with understanding that this is not a run-of-the-mill mm-hmm. induction where you can give them a couple doses of vaginal Cytotec and they're going to be ripe.
Right.
They're probably not going to be ripe till you've given them a total dose of 150. At best.
Higher doses.
With increasing levels of obesity.
And patience.
Yeah, but that's what we're really good at.
Agreed.
I will say that I am seeing more and more facilities be more patient with labor progress. Mm-hmm. Whereas like back in the day, if you fell off the curb, you got cut.
Yeah.
I do not see that happening now. We are giving people a longer duration of time. And I think that's come with the research that's saying like, there's no such thing as a labor curve,
right?
Everybody's body does what they're supposed to do. So we will give people a very long time to make change.
Yeah.
Even a little change.
Yeah.
I think we have to now be thinking about like, are we effectively dosing people? Are we ripening people enough so that when they get to an oxytocin phase that it's works like it's supposed to?
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about here in these last few minutes as you've been talking is that you can have patients that are obese and even higher classes of obesity, but they are active and mobile. It's that idea of like fat and fit kind of idea. But those people that can move about in the bed and change their positions and do all of those things tend to do better as well than someone that is really restricted and has a lot of comorbidities. And so we don't want to forget all of our normal physiologic labor support and position change and comfort measures and all of those different things, just because someone maybe needs an IUPC or an FSE, just because someone does need to be on continuous monitoring.
It stresses me out every single time that we induce somebody that the baby's not in the pelvis.
Yeah, agreed.
Not because cord prolapse is an accident. It happens. That's why it's called a cord accident. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like one of the things I think we're doing with these women who are obese is their babies are like high and not in the pelvis. Mm-hmm. And then we're absolutely encouraging asynclitism mm-hmm. and malposition because A, their bodies aren't ready. B, their babies aren't in a good position to navigate the pelvis. Mm-hmm. And then we're sitting them in bed for 24, 36 hours, ripening them. And their babies aren't figuring out the passenger is a problem in the pelvis.
Right. And but as we've mentioned, I mean, we've said this over and over, we keep coming back to the idea that they may have never been ready and their body may not have labored on its own.
Correct.
Okay. So we've talked about this is a medically indicated reason that we should consider for induction. It matches, we're going to talk about arrive at some point in the future, but it does kind of fit with that idea of 39 weeks is an appropriate time to start thinking about induction. And we should really think about the doses. I love your conversation around meso and also oxytocin.
Just do it. It's like, go. And every time you're thinking about ripening, be like, what is my total dose? That is the most important thing. And have I reached a total dose that is actually going to be effective for this patient in this situation?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, thanks for joining us for this episode of the Engaged Midwife Podcast. We can't wait to talk to you again.
Take care.